Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Car Chat podcast. And with me today, I have Mr. Petrol Ped. Hello. Or Peter.
Hello, mate. How are you?
Very good. Very good.
It's good to be back.
It is. I was looking at it, and the last time you were on the podcast was October 2019, and it was episode 19, which is quite a long time ago, actually.
When nobody knew what COVID was.
No, I know. And I've been speaking to a couple of people recently, I've had a few people back on since before, and it's like we just had no idea at that point in time what was coming.
It's funny, I was watching the new series of Drive to Survive on Netflix, and in the first one they're kind of talking about COVID, and it's retrospectively looking back at it now, how innocent some of the comments were, and how they were like, ooh. And you look back now and think, wow, we just didn't know.
I know, and you almost sort of get like angry, like, what are you guys doing? It's like, no, at the time, this is how everyone was acting, and just a real like drop in. For me, it's like, you're quite a big F1 fan, aren't you?
I do like my F1, yeah. I like all motorsport, to be honest, but I just think, I do like my F1. I know it's boring and dull and predictable sometimes, but I don't know what it is about it. It just has this kind of, this aura. I've always loved it and always look forward to the races. This season especially, I'm looking forward to. I think it's going to be really much better than last year, hopefully.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm sort of like not really an F1 fan that's becoming an F1 fan. And I'm probably one of those annoying people that I used to vaguely follow, like one race a year, two races a year, see what was happening, whatever. And then I watched season one of Drive to Survive.
It was amazing. I think for most people, when they watched it, and if any of your listeners haven't watched it, it's so worth it because you get this completely different view of the sport.
Yeah,
I watched the first series and you just think, how did anybody agree to doing this? It's amazing. The access and some of the conversations they actually put out is amazing.
It is, and I think F1 for so many years. I don't want to talk about F1 very much, but F1 for so many years has been this closed off thing that you're like, you can see the races, you can see the results, but you don't really get any driver opinions. You don't really get too many stories unless you're really, really deep, deep, deep into it. You don't know about these things. And that series for the casual observer has just made it so much more interesting because it's made it about the people.
Yeah. Yeah. Gunter Steiner, who knew what a legend he was until Drive to Survive?
No, absolute hero. So what have you been up to since I last saw you? Well, I know you've been up to a lot. You've been smashing out videos left, right and center.
Yeah, I guess YouTube-wise, I guess the biggest thing, bearing in mind we were talking about COVID, that when... And it's funny, I was looking back, because obviously lockdown in the UK started a year ago yesterday, and I went back onto the channel to see which video dropped. And it was exactly 12 months ago that I announced that, because in the video I say, we think lockdown's going to last 3 weeks, and I'm going to do a video every day for 3 weeks. Talking about, if you like, innocent view of what was going to happen. Yeah. And I did, I called it the COVID-19 daily vlog, which... some people thought was very distasteful, but I just thought was amusing. Yeah, and I did a video a day, every day, for what turned out to be 10 weeks. Now, as a YouTuber that does cars in a time when you're not allowed to drive, that was, it was quite interesting. So,
did you have to, like, get seriously creative in that journey?
Yeah, very. A couple of things. One, I did lots of bits of little modifications and stuff to my car. So I worked with brands that sent me, I don't know, de-chroming kits and things I could do with my car. My favourite one, I've got two Minis. My next door neighbour that lives in the farm next door, they've got five Minis. So in the little set of converted barns we're in, we had 10 Minis. So we ran a Mini car meet in the middle of lockdown.
Nice.
All socially distanced, of course. And then the genius idea was actually my other half suggested it, that I asked my subscribers to send me reviews of their cars. I called them Peddler's Rides, and I did three of those a week. And that was a really nice, great way for people to get their content onto YouTube, but a great way for me to put stuff out. And it must have been so good that Johnny Smith now does it on the Late Break Show, Cars the People. I wonder where he got that idea from. but yeah, it was good. What it did for me, one, it gave me something to do, but it increased the engagement in my audience a huge amount.
Okay.
And that subsequently kind of helped me, I think, and seen benefits. But it was good fun too.
Because you've recently, although I commented on the video, because you recently posted a video saying you've just hit 100,000 subscribers, which I believe you are at now. And then I look at the video and it was like 99.999. I was like, not yet.
So this is called counting your chickens. So yes, you're a content creator. So, you know, you have this content plan, and I've always said I'll put three videos out a week.
Yeah.
And now at the moment, it's actually four.
That's a lot.
And I knew I was going to hit 100,000 subscribers. You see your growth, and I was growing at just over 200 subscribers a day. And I did the rough maths and I thought, well, I'll hit that Monday morning. So I'll put a video out on Monday about me hitting 100,000 subscribers. And I filmed it at the beginning of the weekend, edited it, scheduled it. And literally the second it was scheduled, my subscriber growth rate just hit the floor and was growing at like 50 a day. And it just dragged its heels. So I didn't actually hit 100,000 subscribers till the Friday, so 5 days later.
I thought much
to the amusement of the internet.
What might have happened is you'd posted it and then a whole bunch of people, just to be the internet, had gone unsubscribe.
They did.
Yeah.
So I was going onto my creator studio and I was losing like 5 or 10 or 15 at a time. And I was going backwards. So it was my bad, but I'm there now. So it's been a goal of mine for a long time. So
you can,
but that was amusing.
You can round up 99 to 100. I know you don't get. Do you get a play button of sorts?
Yes, you do. Yeah, you get a silver one. Yeah, that's the one. I don't know. I think when I started, I saw some channels that are now massive getting their first play button and thought, I want one of them. And that's been my motivator for a long time. So to know I'm, you don't get it for ages afterwards though. So
okay,
the pro YouTube spot that you've got your 100,000 subscribers, and apparently, although it hasn't happened yet, in your creator studio, you get a little message from them, and then you can apply for your play button.
Okay,
and then they post it to you. But that it doesn't normally come until maybe 6 months after you've actually hit 100,000 subscribers.
That will
happen.
Cool. That's a really cool thing, I think, because we've all seen these play buttons of various colours and sizes and whatever. And to be able to have one of your own is
pretty sick. It's going to go on the wall just there, just behind me, on my office.
You've got the spot ready.
Yeah.
I saw you did a video. I watched it. It was two weeks ago, about the sort of how to get to, or what you've done to get to 100,000 subscribers. And I thought
that was the one I put out early.
But I thought that was quite interesting. Like, the journey and the things you've done and the things you've learnt over time about growing an audience and maintaining an audience and building a community and all that sort of stuff.
I think it would be a surprise to a lot of people who watch YouTube how much effort is involved. I think, don't get me wrong, there are some channels that just explode because, you know, they'll get a viral video or something that will make them just go from nothing to massive. But that tends not to happen so much in the car space.
Yeah.
I think car channels, unless you've got I even know people who've got big exotic garages full of supercars who struggle to kind of get the growth. So there's no substitute apart from just hard work and regular content. And for me, it was always a case of being very engaged with my followers. So when people comment on videos, you know, I'll try and answer them back. It's getting a bit more difficult now because it's just time. I you know, if I don't look at my comments for a day, then that's 2 or 3 hours worth of work just to catch back up again. So
yeah, that's such a time commitment. I think that's my favorite bit about, because I've sort of experiencing again the beginnings of a channel, because I started the channel that this is on.
I'm going to ask you about the ST video. I watched that yesterday.
Yeah. So I made the decision a year ago or maybe less than that. I don't know. To just have the podcast stuff on a separate channel.
Yeah.
Because it was really, it was killing the views on any video I did on my normal channel, even though over time I was sort of like, well, I kind of would rather just do podcasts. Like it's sort of the avenue that I'm going and the thing that I really enjoy. It's just putting a podcast video in with another versus a review or something. It was just like killed all traffic, killed everything.
The algorithm just doesn't. Not that I don't think any of us understand the algorithm, but the algorithm just doesn't get that at all.
Yeah.
Because I've just started a podcast channel for, I've started doing bike content. And that's an interesting one because the big question for me was, do I put that's push bike, not motorbike. Yeah. Do I push the push bike content out on the main channel or do I do it on a different channel and start something new? Because again, you think, well, it's a car channel, bikes, is that going to be a problem? Now, as it happens, lots of people who own cars normally have two other interests. They normally like nice watches and they like bikes, push bikes. They either like push bikes or absolutely hate them. But a lot of them like nice road bikes and mountain bikes. And it's actually worked okay. But the podcast thing, that's probably a very good shout.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because it's making that call of going from, okay, I've got an established channel of sorts, whatever size it is, and to start a new one, like starting a new channel nowadays, you have to get a certain number of hours, certain number of subscribers before you can monetize. Even then, like, you're not necessarily making any money up till that point because the views are so small. But starting from zero again, difficult.
I can't get my head around the motivation I would need to do that. Actually, it's taken so much effort to get one channel up to where I am. To start again is a big one. I mean, I have with the Cycle Sunday podcast. And I've done that more, actually, because I've a bit like you with doing the podcasting. I've kind of been on one and listened to lots. And I thought, that looks really interesting. I want to give it a go. And we've only done a few for Cycle Sunday, but they're really, really interesting to do and good fun to do.
Yeah, just like you just get to talk and discuss a topic like properly without it being jump cutted because you've got to get it into 10 minutes and you can't go and all of that sort of stuff. How does your content split now between cycling and automotive?
What I do 3 videos a week for the main channel, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And then I got talking to a guy who became a friend through being a subscriber who runs this amazing bike shop in Edinburgh. And we've been talking about a long time about doing some kind of project together to try and do that crossover between bikes and cars. And in the end, we decided that what we were going to do is use the showcase of building the ultimate road bike to talk about all the engineering that goes into a high-end performance push bike. And we decided we'd drop that on the main channel to give it the biggest exposure possible, really. Because we did think about starting from scratch, but in the brutal world of YouTube algorithms, we could create the best content ever and no one would watch it because they wouldn't find it.
Yeah.
So we put it out on a Sunday and we called it Cycle Sunday. So it's like a mini series within the main channel. But because the subject matter is so wide and so much of it, we thought, well, we're never going to get everything into a video that's 20 minutes long, 25 yeah. minutes long, which is really your sweet spot on YouTube. So we thought, well, we'll do a podcast. So at the after each video drops, there's a podcast goes live where we chat for an hour about the details of what was in that video. You know, it might be the technology behind a bike frame or the technology behind wheels or whatever it might be. I've got a YouTube channel for the podcast, but I also use it's on iTunes and yeah. a bit much like you do with this. And I found that really interesting because I didn't have a clue. I really didn't know. I thought, how do you do a podcast? Yeah. So you then suddenly have to, and it's been great to learn the new things you need, the different equipment you use. Publishing it's different. Getting it approved on iTunes. What a palaver that was. It took forever.
Was that a faff?
It only took a couple of weeks, but I think it was probably a combination of my misunderstanding how to do it and it just dragging its heels. But and then Google as well was weird, but I'm on there now. So
yeah, I remember there was a lot of forms. There's a lot of filling in. But if you use, I can't remember, my provider, not sponsored, is Buzzsprout. And
yeah, me too.
And they go, you go, okay, when you start a new podcast, they basically say, click all these links, like yeah. fill in this information and then click all these links. And that takes you to each provider, whether it's Stitchercast or iTunes or whatever. And then you have to drop yeah. in your feed and where you want to put it and yeah. all that sort of stuff and which category and then subcategory. I think that's changed now. It's one of the things that I've discovered over time is, let's say, the iTunes automotive chart. I think the only people that know who is on the iTunes automotive chart are people that produce content on the iTunes automotive chart. Because it's actually impossible to find now. Like, if you go into the app, there doesn't seem to be an automotive section. is cycling, does cycling have its own, or are you under the leisure?
No, it would be leisure. I've not found a specific one. I don't know how important those categories are, to be honest, but you know, I found it really interesting and I'm really chuffed I've done it. And I think what we'll do once we've built the bike, which we haven't quite got there yet in terms of the we've filmed episodes in a big chunk. We'll probably carry on doing the podcast for sure. And then we'll drop videos every Sunday or maybe once a month or something, depending on when we've got content. But the podcast is, especially because I'm in the south of England and Paul's in Edinburgh, logistics are quite tricky.
Yeah. It must be quite interesting. Have you seen a growth in sort of pulling one audience to the other? It's like adding some cycling content. There's a lot of people I know tons of people that are into cycling. I know tons of people that are into cars. But I don't know. I wonder, what's the audience size of the two? Like, is the cycling audience bigger or the same size or smaller than audience?
I mean, you've got massive cycling channels like GCN and so on that are huge. So there is a big cycling community out there. And I've certainly seen, I mean, it's difficult to track, but certainly from comments and a few things, people have found one of the cycle videos and then come on and started watching the other stuff.
Yeah.
What's really interesting and quite pleasing for us is there are people who, when I announced I was going to do it, said, why are you doing that? It's the car channel. It's going to be boring. Have actually said, do you know what? We found that really interesting. And they said, well, I might not go and buy a bike, but I just found it interesting.
Yeah.
Which is always a good information of what you've done.
A year ago, 2 years ago now, this was when I first started getting cycling. I think I'd just done a bit of cycling when I saw you and I just bought a bike, or maybe bought a bike just after. And I've done a bunch more since. And there's so much crossover, I think, as much as some motorists like to hate on cyclists, and I think certain individuals are causing a lot of problem for everyone else. Like, there's a lot in cycling that translates into cars in terms of you like mechanical stuff, you like cool materials, all those things.
Yeah.
Like, it's an endless pit of engineering and expense.
Yeah. And what we've tried to do actually is a lot of the analogies we've been using have been car ones to try and cross over. But I mean, the analogy of what we've done with this bike would be like me going out and specking a McLaren Elva or something. I mean, we've literally gone out and built the best bike with the best frame, the best group set, the best wheels, no expense spared. And when the bike's finished, it's going to be way too good for me.
Is that even a thing? Is that, I've heard that people say that before. Like, oh, I spoke to someone yesterday and they're like, I've got this bike and it's like too good for me. I'm like, that's just not true, is it?
No, it's not. And it's all marginal gains and stuff. And you know, Paul's jokingly in the first episode said you could buy speed, but you know, it's about, I've got nowhere to, no complaint, no, nowhere to blame now. If I do a sportif, I can't blame the bike.
Yeah, yeah.
If I don't get round, it's all on me now. But yeah, it's been really interesting.
What
really
bike interesting.
Are you building? A Bianchi Ultra XR4, which is the factory team bike.
Oh.
And it's having a Campagnolo Super Record EPS gear set. So it's already
super light
of money. It's going to be...
Is it going to be illegal,
so,
light?
No, it'll be... we reckon, we don't know for sure because we haven't built it yet, but we reckon it'll be just over sort of 7.5 kilos. But it's, yeah, I think we're already five figures.
Mm.
As in cost, not weight.
Yeah.
So it's going to be really cool.
That is cool. Right, I think just before... You on the podcast last time. No, actually, when you were on the podcast last time, you had a mini GP3 ordered.
Yes.
What happened to that?
I cancelled the order. So a couple of things. I ordered it long in advance before the car came out, before we even knew what it was going to look like or before we knew what the spec was going to be. Although the car looked amazing to me, one of the things that I got from... I got a long-termer for a Mini. I had a JCW Clubman for 3 months, the 306 horsepower. So the same engine, same gearbox, but four-wheel drive and a bit more practicality. And both my wife and I just utterly fell in love with that car. And for my lifestyle, I just thought, you know, as a YouTuber, GP3 would have been the car to go for. But for me and what I need to use it for on a daily basis, it was a no-brainer, really. So we gave the press car back and went out and bought a JCW Clubman.
Ah,
okay. And I cancelled my order.
What do you particularly like about the Clubman?
It's just a really good all-round car. It's quick. It's practical enough for us. It's not massive, but it's massive for a Mini. But it's got room for... We've got a couple of dogs, got room for the dogs in the back. If you need to go anywhere and carry a bit more stuff, you can stick a roof box or a bike rack on the roof. It's four-wheel drive. It's just a very, very good car. And I think I bought a used one. So I bought, it was a four-month-old ex-demonstrator. Book price was 40 grand. I got it for just over 30.
Ooh,
deals. So it was a no-brainer, really.
Yeah. Do you still have the S4?
No, we got rid of that. So we had the two Minis, so the Roadster and the Clubman and the S4. And we really want to buy an electric car. We'd want to buy a Tesla Model Y.
Okay.
But you can't order those yet. And when lockdown happened, we had three cars and we were like, look, we're just not using them all. We've got, you know, finance on the Audi and the Clubman. Let's just get rid of the Audi. And it was at a time when we got out of it and actually didn't really lose a great deal. So we got rid.
Oh, that's good. I was looking.
And I know you've got one very similar. And I loved the S4. It's such a good car.
It's a great car. But I did look at how much I've paid for it and how much they're worth now versus a year later, and it's not been too good for me. So I'm like, okay, I need to drive it more and keep it for a bit longer for it to even out.
Yeah, well, we had to wait probably 6 months after we really wanted to get rid of it just to get the numbers to work, just to be a bit further into the finance agreement and stuff. And that for me, it's quite an interesting one, because here's a YouTuber that actually can't just flip cars willy-nilly whenever they want, because it's a real car with a real finance agreement. And I don't have thousands of pounds to throw down the drain on depreciation and losing cars. So, there are YouTubers out there that have these real world concerns. So, yeah, so it went, and it was a sad day when it went, to be honest. But we'll see whenever we're allowed to order Model Y.
Yeah, which
isn't available yet.
Thinking about, well, I've driven a couple of electric cars now. The most recent one, I drove a Taycan. The baby, so the rear wheel drive. What a bit of kit. Have you driven a Taycan?
Yeah, I've driven the Turbo S.
The
phenomenal car.
I found that one really interesting, because prior to that, I've driven a Model 3 Performance.
Yeah.
and Honda E. Those are the only electric cars I've driven. And the Model 3, after about 10 minutes, I was like, okay, I've done everything this car does. That was in town, so I didn't get to experience it around town. But I got in the Taycan, or Taycan, and similarly, like, first 15 minutes was like, oh, this is like a really nice car. And it's designed how I sort of expect cars to be designed, as in I can see the speed in front of me on a dash, which with the Model 3, like, you can't. Like, what is, you've got to be sort of driving along slightly looking left a little bit. And I think the thing that most impressed me with that car is the damping. The way that car can go down like a bumpy road is just, I think it's almost like unlike anything I've driven in, definitely in that category, for sure.
So I find it quite interesting with electric car. In fact, I've got a video I'm going to put out on Monday about just, I've called it, why is the EV community so militant? Because they really are, you know, in comments and things. Because I think you can, if you approach an electric car objectively, you've got two things. You've got the car and what it's like to drive and so on. And, you know, something like a Taycan for me, it's not just a great electric car, it's a great car.
Yeah.
I mean, they are phenomenal pieces of engineering. Mind-bendingly quick, or actually probably too fast. Like the Turbo S for me, I think if you bought a 4S or the new rear-wheel drive one, that would be more than enough car.
This was absolutely fast enough.
Yeah. I mean, and it's just a really lovely place to be. And then there's the owning the car and living with the car. And then you have to take into account charging and charging at home, charging in public. And then the debate starts to get a little bit more challenging, because as an ownership experience, I think Tesla have it utterly nailed.
Yeah.
And I think everyone's playing catch up and have been doing so for a long time. But if you're only ever going to be doing 100 miles a day tops, then it doesn't really matter, because if you can charge it up at home, if you've got off-street parking and your own charger, you probably never visit public charging infrastructure at all. In which case, there's a whole bunch of really great EVs out there. I just had the new 2021 I-Pace last week.
Yeah, how was that?
And that was just a fantastic car. And I've got Mustang Mach-E tomorrow, which I'm really looking forward to. And they're really, really good cars. But as soon as you need to charge in public, that's when, for me, the problems start to happen, because it's still just not there, really.
Because I have a friend asked me recently, he's not like that into cars, but he wants to get a new car. And he wanted an electric. It's like, I just want it, you know, all the reasons. And
yeah,
he's like, what are your thoughts? I was like, well, I haven't driven many, but I hear a lot of stories and I've had a lot of ownership experience from other people and stuff like that. And he does a couple of times a year, does a trip down to the Alps to go skiing or something like that. And I was like, you're just not going to do that trip in anything other than a Tesla. Now, okay, some other owners of other cars, there are other cars out there, will probably say you can, but from my experience and everything I've been heard, you don't want to be charging every 200 miles. Like,
no. Well, so I'll give you an example. So since we last spoke, I think I could tell you, but you weren't allowed to put it on the podcast. I did the TV show Vintage Voltage.
Yes. Talk to me about it.
And one of the things, we'll talk about that in a minute. One of the things we did with that was we, as part of one of the shows, we had to pick up a gearbox for a Chesel Speedster that we were doing. It's like a little Porsche Speedster replica. Mm. And we had to go to Hamburg. So we drove to Hamburg in an electric car, in a Kia e-Niro. And we got there and we got back, but it was a very interesting journey. You are at the mercy of charging infrastructure. And sometimes it's phenomenal. The Netherlands was really, really good.
Yeah.
Germany was utterly shocking.
Really?
Yeah.
I was listening to, it was a podcast, this podcast or a video recently, and they were talking about, it might have been the Ford, actually, the Mach-E, and I may not have been, but essentially, if you put in your destination, and let's say I'm in London and I've got to go to Edinburgh, and you put it into your nav, and your Tesla and all electric cars will go, okay, you're going to have to stop twice or once or whatever. Here's the stop. Tesla will go, we know whether there's full or not, supercharger, blah, 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 blah. And this car was taking people when they were on a long journey to, like, the slowest chargers in the world. As in, like, you turn up at this place and it would say, you need to wait 13 hours. And you're like, but I'm on a road trip. I can't wait 13 hours to charge the car up. I think they are now addressing this and realise it's a problem. But
I've said quite a few times, actually, and I think actually going back to the Taycan, I think that's one of the things that Porsche have tried to address, is the integration between the sat-nav and the charge network in most manufacturers' cars is quite poor, whereas in a Tesla, it's phenomenal. And you're right, the new I-Pace's sat-nav has that much, much better.
Yeah.
So it prioritises fast chargers and those types of things. But that's the living with the experience that, you know, and everyone says, oh, you can't, you know, because my benchmark is, we've got a place in Cornwall, it's 230 miles.
Yeah.
I want to be able to drive there without stopping. And everyone's like, oh, you'd only have to stop for 20 minutes, half an hour. And I'm like, yeah, but I don't want to.
Yeah.
It's a faff. And the worst thing is you plan in a stop, you get there and someone's just plugged in. It's now not half an hour, because normally there's only one charger.
Yeah.
It's an hour.
Yeah.
And it annoys me because I really like electric cars. And as I said, the video I literally shot it yesterday, I just can't understand why people just can't understand or appreciate cars. You don't have to, you know, electric or petrol or diesel. I don't care. It's a car. And I've got an appreciation for all those different types of cars and driving them as well. I think if you want the emotion and the visceral feeling of driving a car, an electric car is probably not going to tick that many boxes for you, unless it's a Porsche Taycan or the new Audi e-tron GT, which looks phenomenal as well. But it just ticks different boxes.
Yeah.
A Taycan will bend your brain and your appreciation of the laws of physics. I had one on a day where it rained all day, pretty much. And I did a 0-60 test in the rain with the wipers on, and it did it in 3 seconds.
Yeah.
And you could feel the grip in the wheel. Oh, it was just amazing. It's an amazing thing.
They're amazing things. And
they're just very expensive.
Yeah, they are very expensive. And this is definitely a downside too. But then there are different cars one can find. But I think the thing that sort of really got me, you get it home and I put it in the garage. And then when I want to get in it again, you just unlock it and it starts warming itself up. Don't even have to think about that. And then you get in, you're like, it's warm. And then you drive out of the garage and there's no fumes anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just zip around and you don't have to go to a petrol station ever. Mm-hmm. If you are someone that can use these cars.
Well, if you live in London like you do.
And just my problem with those sorts of electric cars is it's a bigger car. The Taycan is a bigger car. So for me, I'm always wanting to go down to Cornwall. For me, that might be go up to visit some family in Glasgow, or I go to racetracks every now and then. So a big one for me would be, can I go to Silverstone and back? Which is, I looked at it the other day, it's about 160 miles return from me, depending on which way you go.
Yeah.
Which, if your range is 240, something like that, in theory, that's completely fine. But if you're driving on a motorway, you don't get the same level of range. It does go down.
No, although, some of them do have some quite clever range modes, but that generally deadens things off so much they're not that pleasant to drive.
Yeah, I don't want to be... It's like if it's the equivalent of you fill your fuel tank up to the full with petrol and then you arrive home on fumes and that's the experience you have, no one wants to do that. You always fill up like 20 miles before or 10 miles before or whatever. We're nearly there for that, for me. But
yeah,
not quite.
I think
for most
people's journey profiles. I mean, my other half, we live 3 miles from her work, so you know she drives to work, drives around work a little bit each day, and an electric car would be absolutely perfect. You know, you charge at home. We're actually having an electric charger installed at home in a couple of weeks' time, just because I'm getting more and more press cars that are electric, and charging them on a 3-pin granny charger is not ideal at all. So, it will happen.
It will.
It will get better. It has to. Because
Have you driven any
able to buy a petrol or diesel car?
Have you driven any of the little ones?
I have driven
conventional manufacturers.
Zoe.
Okay. Yeah.
Renault Zoe, and Mini, I guess, is another small one. The electric Mini, I think, drives as good as a Cooper S. It's a phenomenal thing.
Nice.
Really, really good. But it'll do 120 miles, and then that's it.
And how much is that car?
Cheaper than the petrol. Yeah, mid-30s. They've got three levels of spec, so I think it ranges from high 20s to mid-30s.
Okay.
Depending on whether you go level 1, 2 or 3.
Yeah.
But the equivalent trim level is cheaper than the petrol car.
Mm.
And what I love about Mini, they're made on the same line. So if you ever go to the Mini Oxford factory, is you'll see the cars coming down the line, and they'll be, you know, that's a petrol one, that's a diesel one, that's an electric one. They're all built in the same line.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Because that for me is that'll be the next step. A small electric car for anything that doesn't need to be a long journey. And then I'm saving.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you look at something like an electric Golf, electric Mini, I've not driven the little Honda thing. I desperately want to drive one.
Yeah, it's quite cool, that.
Fantastic little things. Yeah. Those types of cars, for city driving, they're fantastic.
Yeah. And and if you can do better, really. A little bit of extra, it all works. So you were on TV.
Yeah.
You did a TV show.
Yeah. I am, or was.
You are.
I am. because it's their reshowing series one at the moment. It's on Friday night on D-Max at 9 o'clock. I think when we did the last podcast, I was filming, because I was actually, when I left you, I drove up to Wales to do some filming, but I wasn't allowed to tell anybody about it at that point. But I am, it's been on the telly now. So it's an amazing experience to kind of, I desperately wanted to get into telly. So to suddenly get that opportunity was very cool.
And what were you guys doing? Sorry, I haven't actually seen any of it. And I know, shock horror. But now I can go and watch back season one.
So we, the series is made by the production company that originally made Wheeler Dealers. Mm-hmm. They're working, it's based in a garage in Mid Wales, Newtown in Mid Wales, called Electric Classic Cars. And they take classic cars and convert them to run on electric power by basically either removing the engine and replacing the engine with a motor that then mates to the car's existing gearbox.
Yeah.
So you have an electric car with gears, which is a weird concept.
Yeah.
Or for the more wild conversions, you take the gearbox and the engine out and you put a Tesla direct drive unit in. And then you get super levels of performance.
That sounds
like a Ferrari 308 with a 450 horsepower Tesla drivetrain that will do 0 to 60 in 3 seconds.
What's that like?
Amazing. Driven it. Phenomenal. So the really cool thing, and what I like about the show, but is it riles people. It gets people's backs up big style. You know, are we destroying classic cars and those types of things? The guy who did the Ferrari, he'd owned that car for over 25 years, yeah. I think. And my simple answer is, have you ever owned a classic Ferrari? Because if you do, then you often find yourself going to the garage to get them fixed, or they won't start, or there's constant problems. Any classic car is like that. And he got to the point with his Ferrari that he was only really driving it to the MOT station and back each year, and wasn't driving it, and it wasn't reliable. And he put a tweet up, and Richard, who runs Electric Classic Cars, just sent a tweet back saying, I can make that car better. And spring forward a year or so later, it's running an electric drivetrain from a Tesla Model S. But when you put the motor in, you can do other things. So most of the cars need changing suspension, brakes, weight distribution. So you end up with a car that, you know, a 308 was never a brilliant driving car. Yeah. You end up with a car that has very different handling characteristics, but better. It just doesn't make a Ferrari V8 sound. And when you drive it, it's really funny because you come up behind cars and they are seeing this red Ferrari, like Magnum PI Ferrari, coming up behind them, expecting this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you go, it's really cool. So they've done everything. In series one, we did everything from a classic Fiat 500, a little 1969 Fiat 500. Mm. We did Ferrari 308, Land Rover Defender 110.
Oh, that's
with
quite
a 450 horsepower Tesla. In fact, tune into my channel tomorrow evening, so it will be live by the time this goes out, because they've done a Spectre Land Rover Defender, and that'll do 0-60 in five and a half seconds. And off-road, we drove it up the top of a mountain. It was amazing.
Yeah, those sorts of cars off-road, electric, must be amazing.
Well, yeah, because what they do with the Defender, it is the conversion itself is really interesting, because they use a large Tesla motor, which normally sits on the rear axle between the two rear wheels on a Model S or a Model X. And they rotate it 90 degrees and put it in the middle of the car, the middle of the Defender, with one output drive shaft going to the front axle and the other one going to the rear axle. And then they upgrade the diffs in the axles and in the Tesla unit to Quaife diffs. So you've got three limited slip diffs. And you've got zero torque from zero RPM. It's just an incredible thing.
Yeah, that's...
absolutely incredible thing.
Which was your favourite of the cars you drove?
Well, it's not actually one of the cars that we did on the series. It's Moggy, who owns the garage, has a Beetle that runs 600 horsepower, large Tesla unit. And that thing is utterly, utterly incredible. It's just... he's doing some stuff at the moment to try and turn it into the fastest Beetle in the world. So he's a bit mad, his Al Moggy.
He's like, okay, let's take this to the max. Well, that's what you want.
The great story behind it, I got approached to do it through YouTube. The production company needed a character in the show to... I go off and look at engineering processes, or I do all the client handover at the beginning, at the end of each episode. And they approached me and asked if I'd do it. And I kind of did it, you know, had a couple of screen tests and things, and then went to meet the guys in the workshop to see if we got on okay. And I walked in and we're having a cup of coffee, and then Moggy was looking at me in a strange way, and he just looked at me and went, University of Hertfordshire, 1990 to 94, we were on the same course. And then I suddenly realised that we were in the same course at university 30 years ago.
Wow. No. This is what I found with the Taycan, that, and it was the same with the Model 3. You sort of learn, I kind of learned everything about the car in about 20 minutes. Like,
yeah.
The more you, if you drive it on some really serious roads, the Taycan especially was just amazing at dealing with all that stuff. But the sort of stop go, the powertrain, I was just like, okay, I've actually learned, I sort of feel like I've actually learned everything about this car in about 20 minutes. Whereas in a car where you're changing gears and whatever, constantly, you might be learning more or improving. How were these sort of slightly more nutty builds in that aspect?
One of the characteristics of an electric car that you don't have so much in an internal combustion engine car is the whole regenerative braking thing.
Yeah.
I know you get a little bit of engine braking, but I mean, something like a Tesla has quite aggressive engine braking. The Taycan, the same thing. I know you can turn it up or down. So you learn to use that in your driving. So the cars that Moggy does, again, have that element of regenerative braking. The interesting one, so the cars that maintain the car's original gearbox, so they take a smaller power motor. We often use something called a net gain hyper 9. It's about 120 horsepower or so. And they create a new adapter plate and make that to the existing gearbox in the car. So then all you need to do for city driving is just stick it in second or third and just leave it there. You don't need to change gear at all. And that's very weird, because you turn the car on, you use the clutch to put the car in gear, but then you can lift the clutch off because it's an electric car, so you can't stall it. And then you just drive it around on the throttle. It's really weird. And you can change gear as you're going along. If you went onto a dual carriageway, you could change up into third or fourth gear. And you use the clutch in and change gear like you would normally do.
But there's no biting point. You just...
No.
Clutch, no, change, it's gear, weird.
Yeah.
Done.
Because you kind of get in it and turn it on and you're like, oh, no, it's on. Because it's not making any noise. So they're fun to drive. We did a Karmann Ghia, for example. And beautiful looking car, but never has a car been made to look so fast and actually go so slowly.
Yeah.
Because they had 30 or 40 horsepower. This Karmann Ghia had 120 horsepower. So it was much more nippy, much more zippy in traffic. They sorted the suspension and the brakes out, so it went around corners and stuff as well. So they are, if you ignore the noise, which is probably the only bit that's missing, and this is where you get grief from the kind of classic car owners appreciation society, they're often actually better cars to drive because they've got more power, more modern levels of power, and better suspension and better brakes and better weight distribution, and they're great fun to drive.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting space, and like you said, there's room for all of these things. You can have one, and you can have the other. And I absolutely will own an electric car at some point soon-ish. I don't know when, but for around town and short journeys and whenever I can make it work, and then I'll have a car that makes some noise for some fun other times.
Exactly, and a lot of the guys that have had the cars converted, because that's the big thing about the show, they aren't created for the TV show. They're real clients with real money. It's the client's car. But But a lot of them live in, there was one of the guys, his son was coming back from having worked in America and owned a Tesla in America. They lived in Dublin and they had a Lancia Fulvia and they converted a Lancia Fulvia. And that was going to be his son's city car and drive around. And you get all the benefits of being in an electric car, but you're looking cool because you're in a Lancia Fulvia. And that's what a lot of them, you know, a lot of the owners want is that classic car style, but with the electric car drivability and, you know, environmental credentials and stuff.
Yeah. And you do get, you get some really hardcore people at one end and hardcore people at the other end. But I don't think anyone, no one really likes cars that don't work. So if you've got a car that's constantly like not working or not reliable, I can't deal with that. I don't have at the moment have enough time to go, I'm driving somewhere and I can deal with a breakdown in the middle or at the start or at the end. That's just not an option for me.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I was speaking to someone the other day. They said, look, the thing I love about my classic car is tinkering with it at the weekend and fixing it. I'm like, that's fine. Don't electrify it. But if you want one and you want to use it every day, then that's a way to go. And most of the cars that we've done and are doing, very rarely are they concourse, super valuable, amazingly, you know, rare cars. They're normally, you know, they've got a story to them. You know, they've got an engine that's been, you know, broken in the past and replaced with the wrong engine, or has blown up, or you know, isn't particularly reliable. And I think we have this love affair with the classic cars, and actually forget, you know, Ferraris are a great example. Everyone loves a classic Ferrari, but if you look at a Ferrari 308 when it's in bits, like I did when they were doing them, they are shocking. They're so badly made, it's unbelievable. You know, they're not, I don't know whether they've ever heard of, you know, like spirit levels and set squares and stuff in the Ferrari factory back in the day. Because there's like, you know, angles and, you know, you look at them at different angles and the bonnet line and the boot line will be different. It's terrible.
Yeah. No, it's
obviously, disclaimer, that's not necessarily how it is.
That's not necessarily.
Ferrari all. Listening, because I want to get a car from you.
I've driven a couple of Fords, well, a Ford recently, and you've been driving some Fords recently. You've driven a company called Hendy Performance.
Yeah.
So you've driven a Focus and an RS from them.
Yeah, yeah.
So what are they and what are they like?
So Hendy Group are a car dealership on the south that deal with across a whole bunch of different car brands, but their performance part, Hendy Performance, do all the kind of tuning work and stuff. And what they like to do is, I guess, much like lots of tuning companies, they'll use a car as almost like a test mule to see just what they can get away with and, you know, what power increases they can get. They'll try out different parts, turbos, maps, braking parts, breathing parts like intakes and exhausts and stuff. And they put them on the car and play with them and see how they go. And then that's what filters down into the performance upgrades they'll sell their customers. But the thing I love about Hendy Performance is they do that and then they let their customers drive the cars because they actually use them in their hire car or their courtesy car fleet.
Oh, nice.
So I've got a really good relationship with them. So they've let me play with a few and they are mega things. They've got you mentioned the Focus RS that's running about 500 horsepower. And that was so boosty. It was brilliant. It would be probably like driving your F40 actually.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're nothing at all and then everything.
Yeah.
And then just a couple of weeks ago, they got a little Fiesta ST, which is an older car. It's a 2015 car, I think. But that's running 340 PS or 335 horsepower.
Can it remotely put that power down?
Yeah, it was surprising. It's got a Quaife diff up front and upgraded clutch. And I thought it would be, because my Mini runs 270 brake through the front wheels and it's got a Quaife diff and uprated clutch. And that's a bit hairy. But yeah, it was surprising. I mean, Fiestas are brilliant anyway. You had that I noticed you had
the addition.
Fiesta ST with the Quaife diff. And they are brilliant, brilliant little cars. So when you give them a bit more power, then they just lap it up.
Yeah, I'm definitely going through a bit of a sort of low power.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Our thing at the moment of driving, trying to drive small fun cars that are less expensive, yeah, and less power. And the thing I loved about that ST edition is it's 200 horsepower, which, yeah, you go, okay, that's less than 700 horsepower, but it means you can, it's still way faster than you can go on a road, but you can put your foot down for like a couple of seconds.
Yep. The one thing, and when I got into YouTube, I thought, oh, I get to drive some supercars because I'm not in a position to be able to afford to buy them. And I've been very lucky. I've got to drive quite a few. I had the McLaren 620R a few weeks ago, a couple of months ago now. Phenomenal car. But on the road, I'd give me a Fiesta ST anytime. If you gave me a bit of B road and a Fiesta ST or a McLaren 620R, I'd have the Fiesta every time because the McLaren's so fast. It'll do the speed limit in first gear, pretty much. So you can't really, on a racetrack, totally the other way around. So yeah, 200 brake in a car, you have so much fun without getting into loads of trouble.
Yeah. And
that's why I love the GR Yaris, because GR Yaris isn't ridiculously powerful, but it's so much fun.
See, I had the Yaris
you have one of those
and the Fiestas, yeah, sort of back to back, like 2 weeks apart.
Yeah.
And Yaris, I really enjoyed. And then I drove the Fiesta and I really enjoyed that. And there's bits about the Yaris I really like and bits about the Fiesta I really like. I found the Yaris so locked down. Like, it's just, you can give it like full beans the entire time and it will just take it and off you go.
Yeah.
You don't feel like the car's moving around. Definitely not at the speeds I drive on the road. Like, it was not happening. Whereas the Fiesta, it does move around. Like, that rear comes around at sensible speeds.
Yeah. Because I hear people about Yaris. Oh, Yaris, is it rear-wheel drive or four-wheel drive with rear-wheel bias? You can drift it and stuff. Mate, you'd have to be an utter hero to drift one of those on the public road, because you'd have to be going so fast by the time you actually got the back end going.
I haven't seen
like Petter Solberg or something.
Many clips or any clips of anyone drifting one on a road. There's loads of videos of people in the wet, in the snow, whatever, pulling a handbrake, but no one is coming out of a corner on opposite lock. It's basically not happening.
You mentioned the handbrake. The thing I love about the fact they've engineered the handbrake to disengage the diff at the back so you can use it. I mean, things like that is just genius.
It's a very cool project. I thought it's a very cool little car. It just has a lot of grip.
Give me a Yaris with either a Fiesta or a Mini interior. Oh, winning every day. I couldn't live with the Yaris interior, I'm afraid.
Yeah, the Fiesta interiors. It's just a really great car, that, isn't it?
it is, And they're not silly money. I know they're expensive. I mean, all I don't think there's such a thing as a cheap car anymore. All silly money, really. But I think, you buy a year old. I always say to people, don't buy them new then. Buy a year old demonstrator. I've never bought a new car in my life. You know, I saved 10 grand on my Clubman because it was 4 months old.
Yeah. I had this conversation with Matt Pryor recently. Yeah. And I was asking him, I said, because do car journalists have a bit of a thing here? Because does anyone in your office buy a new car? That's what I was saying to him. Like, anyone, any of the journalists, sort of, and I'm going to be like, kind of excluding, okay, you may not be going out to buy a supercar because you guys don't get paid enough. Like, fair. Mm. But do you buy any new car? He was like, no, I don't think anyone. He was like, oh, someone had a nearly new. I was like, yes, nearly new. Or like 2 years old or 1 year old. And we're all being fed these new cars to buy. But not many people I know in the automotive world actually buy new cars.
Yeah, do you know why? Because they know that you, unless you're very clever about it, you're going to lose a truckload of money.
Yeah.
And I get quite frustrated because I've never bought a new car in my life. And that's another reason why I bottled it out of the GP3 as well, actually, because I thought I'd buy a new one because it's a limited edition and it's probably a relatively safe investment. And I just started to get a bit worried about it. Mm. But all people seem to be interested in is what your monthly payments are going to be. And for me, I mean, I've done a couple of car financing videos on the channel before, and I just think it's just not the only bit of the story. It's the total cost of ownership. Because people say, oh, you know, I can get this for such and such a month and then I'll just chop it in for another one. Well, it doesn't work like that. You lose a lot of money.
I think
you only have to be burnt once. I got burnt badly on a BMW a few years ago, 15 years ago, and we lost a lot in 12 months. And you only do that once.
That's it. You only do it once. Or
unless you can afford to do it more than once, of course, which I can't.
Yeah, but even that's, you know, if it's one of those topics that actually makes me rage a lot recently. And I was on a phone call to a charity recently, and they were sort of telling me about what they do and stuff like that. And they hand out food to give out food to people that can't afford to feed their kids. So it's generally aimed at giving people some food. So, and they sent a food box around to a house, and it was quite a nice house, and they had two new, like, decent cars on the drive, and then they couldn't afford to feed their kids. And you go, well, something's gone very wrong. But ultimately, I was like, I just don't understand how this happens. But their outgoings have exceeded their income, and those two cars are probably a major part of that. And it's something that it really makes me rage about, kind of how finance is pushed these days. Everything is about what the monthly cost is. And if you are aware of all of the facts and you make the decision, fair.
I know someone who is in the car trade and had a customer who, it's a couple of years ago now, they were in a finance deal and they wanted to get into a new M5 competition. And they talked to my friend about it, and then they ended up going via a BMW dealer, and they rolled their finance into an M5 competition. And then he came to my friend probably about 10 months later, 12 months later, saying, look, I need to kind of get out of it. Can you run the numbers and see where I am? He was £50,000 in negative equity. And that, you know, that's doable quite easily if you're not careful. If you just keep rolling things in, and I know some people play the game. I just don't, it's not a game I want to play. My mini's on finance, my clubman, but it's, you know, I check the total cost of ownership. And at the end of it, I know I'll either buy it out or I'll move the car on. But I'm comfortable with that, and I would be financially able to do that. But so many people don't think about what that number's going to be. They enter it because they think what the monthly is going to be. They need to get out of it 12 months later, especially the amount of people in the kind of current pandemic where they need to get rid of their outgoings and think, I know, I'll get out my finance agreement on my car. And then you go and get the numbers run and you're going to lose a truckload of money.
Yeah, you just can't. I can't accept that loss. And it's not like accepting the loss. I don't have the money to pay it out.
Yeah.
I think it's a real thing that's on my mind at the moment. And
the thing is, I've tried a couple of times to put that subject out, and you do get a lot of quite kind of opinionated people. But it's, at the end of the day, it's everyone's got to make their own decision about where they finance stuff from. But I do think that there's a danger of people going into agreements that are in the long term going to be financially very bad for them.
Yeah, and if you've, like you said, if you know all the information and you've made the decision and no one's pushed it on you and gone, this is cheap, then absolutely. Like, I have some finance. I know loads of people with have finance, but if all goes wrong tomorrow, I'm not in a really bad way. And if I have to get rid of one of my cars, I'm not in a really bad way. But it's just that thing of, and I've spoken to so many people, or a couple of people, and they're like, oh yeah, but it's only this amount a month. a typical example was this guy, friend that got a Tesla. Now, he got a Tesla because all sorts of benefit in kind, deals through work and whatever. But he went from a car that was worth virtually nothing to now they've bought a new Tesla and they'll keep it for 3 years and then they might buy another one or something. And you go, okay, well, as long as you're happy with the total amount that's going to cost you, and I think it works out fine for them or whatever, but like you get at the end of that, you have no car and you have spent that amount of money. So if that's okay, if you're okay with that and you go, oh yeah, but I could get a new one. Like, yeah. So for then the next 3 years after that, you've spent the same amount of money a year, like owning a new car every year for 5 years.
That's why I love my, so my little Roadster out there, I bought that cash. Okay. And at the time I was looking at buying an Audi S5 Cabriolet and it was going to be like £42,000 car at the time. This is 5 years ago. And I bought my Mini for 20 and I paid cash. And I've always loved the car because I've always owned it outright. And it costs me tax and you know, an MOT and a service each year and the insurance. That's it.
Yeah.
And it's great. I love it. And I, you know, I know that's... But a bit like you, the most really common comment I get when you film a car that's quite an expensive car, because let's face it, most cars from your BMW, Audi, that kind of, they're normally 60, 70, 80,000 quid before you even start getting
lop off on it. 20 after you've bought it.
And people say, oh, but it's not about what it, it's not about how much the car is, it's what it is per month. I'm like, that's actually not true.
That's incorrect. That is an incorrect statement.
Yes. It's what you put in, what you pay a month, what it's worth at the end.
Yeah.
Anyway, so
it's an interesting topic, and I would just like there to be more from the industry side of realistically, like, this is what it's going to cost. Like, yes, this might be a month, but you're not putting that into the car. That's literally you're paying interest or whatever, and you're not getting this back. You do not own an asset at this point.
And I guess the challenge for the industry is it's not in their interest to do that. But
no,
because they just want to sell cars, they should do. And there are companies out there that are very much about a long-term relationship with the customer. So you don't, you buy a car and screw them over after 2 years, they're not going to come back and buy another car from you.
No.
But if you can kind of make it a longer term play, then that's good. But I think there's a responsibility for car creators on YouTube to do more of that as well. I think there's a lot of, and I'm not naming names or anything, but there are a lot of cars owned by well-known YouTubers that are financed in ways that aren't necessarily apparent to how it appears on screen, you know, and you know, I think it would help a great deal with the youth that watch YouTube, especially, to understand that some of these cars have a backstory behind them. They're not just, you know, you don't just start a YouTube channel and afford to buy these cars. They cost a lot of money.
They do. And like you said, like various brands, lots of the German brands and other brands offer deals for people. And historically, they've been for celebrities, or if you're a racing driver, if you're part of the BRDC and stuff like that, you get really good finance deals. Like one that was going around recently, M2, and it was like a couple of grand down, and then I think it was £200 a month. And you go...
Where do I sign?
And even then...
Total cost of ownership.
Even then, I look at that and go, okay, you're still £5,000 in the first year, and then it's another £2,000. Okay, that's still a relatively cheap deal for the car.
But
buying any of these things new, loads come with discounts. You get hefty... I know multiple situations where people have had cars for... Essentially, they can give the car back at the end of their time with it, 2 years, sell it, and they've not lost any money because the price that they've actually paid for it is less. Now, this does not happen with all brands and all manufacturers and whatever, but there are certain brands and certain cars where there are insane deals, and no, that YouTuber has not paid full list price. And if it was, they would not do it. Yeah, it's a sort of transparency thing. I don't think anyone would have a problem.
Proper can of worms are opening there, mate.
I think it's fine, though. Like, I don't think anyone... No honest, genuine person, and I'm not saying anyone isn't, if you spoke to them about it and directly asked them, said, how much are you paying a month? Yeah. Or how much is it costing you? they'd be honest about that. And then the flip side as well, from the YouTube point of view, is you can offset costs. If you're a certain size and you generate a certain income and it's all through YouTube, you can offset like depreciation, you can offset anything, any money you've spent on the car, because it's a business. And that is, that's another side of it. So it's not necessarily, they might have paid full whack for it, but they can just offset so much of the costs. So it's not, that's another way of it, it can work. So it is.
So that's the only reason to do YouTube.
yeah, exactly. Earn enough money through YouTube so you can start offsetting your car habit. It's a great way. So, have you done some racing? You were going to do some Caterham racing. Did that happen?
I did Caterham last year. So I raced with the Caterham Graduates Racing Club last year at Silverstone, which was fantastic. The year before, I'd done Enduro KA, a couple of rounds of that, which is a brilliant, fun series to do. But the chance to race Caterham, because I used to own a Caterham, and in fact, that's the number plate from my old car. That's the only bit of the car that I've got left over my shoulder for those listening. It was a mega weekend. Very, very scary and very enjoyable at the same time. Because Caterhams are, because I'd done racing in either a Clio or a 4KA, they're an enclosed car.
Yeah.
So you can get quite, rub door handles with people and you're inside a car. In a Caterham, you're not. There's like wheels and suspension bits sticking out and you're open to the elements. So it was a brilliant weekend.
Were you wearing arm harnesses?
Yes, I was. But interestingly, so on the test day I didn't have them, but I got some for the race, They're very weird.
For people that have not come across this or don't know what this is, what was I racing? I raced an MX-5 for a bit and someone was like, have you got arm harnesses? I was like, what are you talking about? And essentially, there's some leashes that you attach to your 5-point harness and they clip in and they go around your wrists or your arm.
Yeah.
And then they are a certain length. So you're basically, your hands cannot go over a certain distance from the belts. Because what happens in open cars, we don't use them in a radical because you're really deep and it's just not so much of a thing. But if you've got a sill that's lowish, what happens is you can be in an accident and your arm can get thrown out of the car. And there are multiple cases of this. And then your arm gets crushed between whatever the car is and whatever it hits, whether it's another car, a wall, the floor.
Yeah.
And there are some horrific injuries from people's arms going out of cars and then getting absolutely mangled.
And I didn't even know it was a thing until I went out and did some practice. And then someone came and says, where are your wrist restraints? I'm like, what are you talking about? And we got some. I borrowed some off somebody for the race. But yeah, they're weird because they're very, it's a bit like the first time I wore a hands device, it was horrible for the first 20 minutes because you're so restricted in terms of your head movement. But it's the same with the wrist restraints, but after a little while you kind of get used to them. But yeah, it was amazing. I have to say though, a lot of the guys that do Caterham Graduates have already done the Caterham Academy series for either one or multiple years.
Yeah.
And then what happens, because the Caterham Academy has a set number of years, and then at the end of it you have to kind of drop off and go and do something else. So the Graduates Club are for those people that just want to go racing Caterhams but not be part of the academy. So they're all proper handy peddlers. There were some really, really fast guys. And I was chuffed. The first race I got best improver, so I actually won something. I won a little trophy, so I was dead chuffed with that. But they're so fast, so quick, but brilliant fun. Yeah, it was one of those memorable YouTube experiences that I wouldn't have done had it not been for YouTube. And I'd love to do some more. I've got, my license is there. It's hanging. I've got it here, dangling in front of me. So I just need to try and find some racing this year, which as yet I haven't managed to do so, but hopefully I will do.
For your license, did you have to go and do like a ECG and stuff like that?
No.
Not yet.
Not yet. If I wanted, so I've got a race national, which is what was the national A now. So
national B?
So it was national B, and then you do your six races with the cross on the back, and then you go to national A. That's now race national.
Okay.
So I've got that. But I could get the international license, and that's the one where you need to do a stress test ECG. Because I know last year I was going to do some racing in a little metro at Spa and Le Mans, and I thought I might need an international license to do that, so I looked into it. But it's really expensive.
It is much more expensive.
The medical's 300 quid. The license is 300 or 400 quid. So you're in for quite a lot before you even pay for all your racing and stuff. But I didn't need it, as it happens. Have you got that?
Yes. And if you do need to do that, the problem I think I ran into when you're trying to upgrade from National B, National A to International C, like you said, you need a whole bunch of stuff done by different doctors and different people and whatever, which then costs a bunch of money. I found a doctor that will do them all in one.
Oh,
and I think it cost me like 100 quid. And he did them all in one go.
Wow. Wow. We'll speak after this, because I'd love to have it. As much as to say, because sometimes a couple of years ago, I had my National B and I got an opportunity with Alfa Romeo. And they said, look, would you like to come out to Italy and drive this race car? and I had to have an international license. And I said, I've not got the right license. So it's a bit like you'll find a lot of YouTubers have a race license, not because they race, but because they want to be able to drive up the hill at Festival of Speed, which is a very, very good reason to have a race license if you're a YouTuber.
For any manufacturers listening, if you need a random person, I have an international C license.
Yes. And, joking aside, I'll let it be known to manufacturers that you have and you're going to be there, because the amount of drivers that don't turn up at FOS. I mean, I got a drive, it'd be 3 years ago now, in a £5 million Alfa Romeo, because the driver turned up without his license. And I drove up in this one-of-one 1959 1900 Sports Spider. Beautiful, beautiful thing.
Unreal.
I had a meeting in the morning with Alfa Romeo and just said, I've got a race license, by the way. And they rang about 40 minutes later and went, where are you? Our driver's not turned up. Get to the assembly area. Amazing. We'll meet you there with a race suit and a helmet.
I am totally, totally going to start putting this on any documentation that goes out, because I sort of assume, and I don't know why, definitely not rightly, definitely wrongly, that when you're doing stuff with people or whatever, that they vaguely look into what you do. And the answer is not necessarily, or sometimes. And because I've had the questions.
Help them out by giving the information.
Exactly, exactly. You've got to put as much information in front of them as possible. But I've had one where I can't remember what I was trying to drive. It was something quite interesting. And part of the forms, they were like, do you have a driving license? It's like, what do you mean, do I have a driving license? This is like a stupid question. You're like, I understand. You clearly, there's been no looking at all. But you're like, do you not see what we do here? Like,
I always try, you try and let people know.
Absolutely.
The one I'm doing this year, I'm going to be doing my Institute of Advanced Motorist Masters this year. And that, I had a call about it last night, and I'm actually quite intimidated by it now.
What do you have to do for that?
So it's the highest civilian driving qualification. So all on the road. Mm. It's basically the level of driving that a high speed pursuit police driver would drive to. I think there are only something like 1,000 people in the country that have it. It's going to be quite interesting to. I've been an advanced motorist for 13 years, but I haven't really done a great deal with the IAM. But I'm going to be doing that this year. So
do you find
that hot off the press? I haven't even announced that to the channel yet.
Oh, well, yeah, there we go. Breaking news, probably in a month.
Yeah, So basically, you get assigned a mentor, and then it takes about 6 1.5 hour sessions to kind of get to the point where you can have your test. And then the test itself is 1.5 to 2 hours on the roads. And you have to do a commentary drive for the whole of that. So, it's pretty full on. But it's not... A lot of people think, do you go fast and stuff? You're not allowed to break the speed limit. If you break the speed limit at all, it's almost like an instant fail. So it's not beyond the speed limit, but it's all about safety and observation and planning and positioning of the car, and you need to make progress. You need to drive quickly, but within the governs of the law. It should be quite interesting.
I always found those things quite interesting, because I remember Tim Schmee, He did his advanced something ages ago. He was telling me about it. He was saying, yeah, you have to do this commentary drive, blah, 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 blah. And it was something that it used to interest me. And it does, driving better does interest me. And like having a better process for driving does interest me. And then I think I've sort of got lost on it because I just started doing loads of track driving. But it's not the same. That's not the same thing.
They're very different techniques. I mean, the big one, the big difference between roadcraft, which is what the police get, how the police get taught to drive, which is what the Institute of Advanced Motorists teach, is you don't do any engine braking. So in a track driving, you'd heel and toe, and you'd change down through the gears, and all that. You don't do any of that on the road. So it's you know, your brake pedals to stop, your throttles to go, and you don't use the engine for braking at all. So it's very different technique of driving.
You don't use the engine, braking. You brake when you hit the brake pedal.
No, so so if you came into a corner and let's say you're in fifth gear and you came up to a corner and it was going to be a third gear corner, you would slow car down with your brake.
Yeah.
And then when you got to the corner, you'd maybe even block change from fifth to third. And then you'd accelerate through the corner in the correct gear. So you wouldn't change to fourth, lift the clutch, brake on the engine, change down to whatever. So
yeah.
It's a very different technique. But
do people do that on track? In a non-sequential car? No, I'm just thinking, like, if you had to go from a fourth gear corner to a second gear, in a sequential, obviously you just go boom, 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 which would be doing the engine braking. But in a manual car, I don't know, do people do that?
I guess people do. It depends on how hot, on a track day I would. I'd go down through the gears but if you're racing, I remember when I did the Clio racing, I thought, well, I haven't got time for changing down gears. I'm just going to smash the brake pedal and go from fifth to second or whatever it would be.
I don't know. I think it absolutely case by case basis, because I know if I'm, and this will just be my skill level at changing down and matching revs and whatever, I probably would lean towards going fifth, if it's into a second gear corner, fifth, second, and do that rather than go fifth, fourth, third, second, because I know I wouldn't be able to keep consistent braking pressure through three gear changes.
I guess it's also depends on the car and how easy it is to heel and toe and those types of things.
Yeah, this is a question I will ask a racing driver next time I talk to them.
Get someone who knows what they're talking about podcast.
Just two guys how to do this, so can we work this out?
Ollie Webb, if you're listening, Sam needs to find out how to break into a corner.
Yeah. I do not know how to break. What else have you been doing? You've driven the M2 CS.
Yes. Yeah, I was very lucky. I had done one of those for a week, actually.
Nice.
I was on Cup 2s, though, and it was a really wintry, cold, wet week. So it was a little bit sketchy. I don't know why press teams put press cars in the winter on summer tyres. I had a Giulia Quadrifoglio in the winter on P0 courses, and it was just horrific. But no, the M2 CS, what a car. Amazing car. But here's the thing, and I kind of said it in my video. I think it is an amazing car, and clearly it's like 25 grand more than an M2 competition. But I think for the average driver, even a pretty good driver, the extra bits, the extra difference, I think most people probably aren't good enough a driver to tap into. So I think you'd just be better off buying an M2 competition and saving yourself 25 grand.
When, and you don't even save 25, you save 35 or something, because an M2 competition, you don't have to buy new.
Yeah, well, yeah, true. And then maybe chuck 5 or 10 grand at a big brake kit, you know,
some suspension
upgrade, decent exhaust, and you'd end up with a car that would be 90% of the car you need, really.
Yeah,
that's not to say the M2 CS isn't an amazing car, and I wanted one badly after my week with it. The one I had the carbon ceramic brakes, which again, for me on the road, were just 6 grand that I could have spent on something else.
Yeah. Less brake dust, though.
clean, that's probably the only advantage, is you get clean wheels.
Yeah, which is really quite nice. I had a friend that had a GT3 for a while, a GT3 RS, and it had red wheels, and he had didn't have ceramics. And he's like, he's just cleaning these things like every day. And I was like, I don't have this issue. the thing, like the CS, I would love to drive one back to back with a competition, just to really compare back to back. And then I watched a video, a Harry's Garage, Harry Metcalf video recently. Yeah. And he was talking about the weight of the CS. Now, on paper, the CS is listed as like the same weight as a competition, pretty much, if you look up their numbers. But he then added up all of the weight saving things on the car. It's got lighter wheels. It's got a lighter bonnet. Mass. It's got a lighter roof. It's got lighter interior. Like all of these things. And he's like, I don't, this doesn't make sense that it's got.
Where's the heavy stuff?
Like what's heavier? And
I know.
I think he got it down and was basically like, I think it's about 90 kilos lighter. He hadn't weighed it yet. So someone weigh one and tell me, is it lighter than a competition? Because it damn well should be.
That's a really good point, actually. Yeah.
Because if it's 100 kilos lighter, that's a lot.
Yeah, because where's the weight gone? Because it's not, can't be engine, gearbox. But yeah, it's a really good point, actually. I've not thought that.
So someone somewhere, if anyone's listening and anyone's got one or got access or come across the weights of an actual customer car of a competition versus a CS, actually someone like Litchfield might be a good one for that because they get these cars in all the time doing their remaps and things. No.
I mean, they're a sensational car. And I think, you know, that and the M5 comp are my two favourite BMWs. I've got the new M3 and M4 week after next. And I can't wait to get my hands on those two. So that'll be interesting to drive those back to back.
I think it will be interesting. I spoke to someone about these cars recently and I got in a bit of a rage. So I will avoid this topic.
Oh, really? I'll move on, shall we?
No, I think it, from a driving point of view, I think it would be really interesting to drive, see what's changed, all that stuff.
Styling wise, you're not so keen.
I can't just get rid. This is the same thing of like, well, one, I'm not the person that's buying a new M3 or an M5 for all the reasons previously discussed in this podcast.
Yeah.
I'm not an idiot. 75 but grand, I'm not saying if you want to and you accept that you're going to lose 30 grand or whatever, fine. But I'm not even getting to the asking about the finance numbers because I'm just not buying that car. It just looks awful.
They do look a lot better in person than they do on the pictures. I mean, I think when most of us saw the nostrils and stuff, it was like, oof, hello. And then you see one and they grow on you quite quickly. There's lots of cars. I've got a Mini Clubman. And when that came out with the rear doors, it was like, what on earth is that? Yeah. And now I've got one and I love it. So they do grow on you. But yeah, I think they look less garish on the M cars because they don't have the kind of biggest surrounds around those nostrils. So they kind of sit into the car. But yeah, I just can't wait to drive them. I've heard so much about, having spoken to a few people who have driven them, the one thing that no one can really get their head around is the fact they're rear-wheel drive. They've got so much traction.
Right.
I saw Chris Harris said he had the car for 2 days before he realised it was rear-wheel drive. He assumed it was an X-drive, which I thought, from Chris Harris, that's quite a good quote. So
that comes down to this cars that are so locked down. Anyway, I will report back in 2 years' time whether I think it looks good. Because a car that I thought looked pretty weird when it first came out, definitely a lot better than this, but weird, was the Aston Martin Vantage, the new shape.
Yes.
And I now look at a Vantage with the non-changed grille. You know, you have two options. Yeah. And I go, oh, that looks quite cool. Looks quite modern, different. Cool.
Have you seen the new F1 edition?
Yes.
Oh, it's just, oh, lovely.
Quite a cool thing.
Yeah.
But I I'm not about the wing.
No, I love wings like that. So yeah, that would be that me all over. It's kind of got that GT8, GT12-esque thing. Yeah. I always thought when it came out, what would that be like with a kind of GT8, GT12 wing on the back?
But the GT8 wing is massive.
Oh, true. Yeah.
That one's like a piddly little Performante wing thing.
You want a bigger wing?
If it's going to have a wing, it needs a bigger wing. Yeah, for sure. Needs some downforce.
Land aircraft on it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I do like, and they're great cars to drive as well, the Vantage.
That's really a nice car. I've been looking at sort of cars of that ilk recently, and I haven't driven one yet. And it's a car I'd really like to drive. And it's got loads of... The thing that sort of surprises me about that is it's got loads of boot space, like tons.
Hmm?
Same as the sort of F-Type.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they've probably got more than an F-Type, actually, because I think F-Type If you get the convertible one, it's
oh, did he? Yeah.
There's very few cars have less boot space than a convertible F-Type, let's face it.
Yeah. That's got to be the one thing. My one problem with convertibles is boot space. Boxster does quite well, but everything else, you just have nothing. And I look at those cars and go, well, I would like to take that away for a weekend. And then you go, but you can't.
You need a Mini Roadster. You need a Mini Roadster, mate. They've got a massive boot in a Mini
That's
Roadster.
That's the one. That's the one.
There you go. Get a set of golf clubs in mine.
Ideal. Ideal. I normally wrap these up with five questions. Since you've been on here before, I'll edit it down a little bit. Five car garage, unlimited value.
Oh, unlimited value. Mm. Hypercar stroke supercar wise would have to be either a McLaren F1 or, and you'll like this one, or a Ferrari F40 for me. Ooh. Because they're the poster cars of my youth. And I think they're both, unfortunately, they're both, you know, ridiculously expensive now. But there's something about both of those cars. Although now you maybe want the new Gordon Murray car because that looks sensational thing. Oh,
it's a very, just the tech specs of that car get me very excited.
We can nerd out. When it comes to engineering in cars, I nerd out with that, or you talk about the kind of Koenigsegg engineer and the engine and the free valve technology and stuff in that. Just, it blows my mind. So, that would be the kind of the hero or poster car in there. An everyday car would probably be something like an RS6 or an RS4, I think, just from a, they're practical, they're fast. And
not a Taycan?
The electric car, I'd have the Taycan. I'd probably have the Taycan, the new estate version, the Turismo one.
Sport Turismo.
Because that does look. Whoa, that looks
what
really
about
good.
Though? It's got the stupid plastic black coloured bits on the arches. Okay, I've given away my opinion on it, but like,
but I think that the Taycan, whether it's that or the Sport Tourism one, would be my other half's car because she, I have lots of press cars, and Tracy absolutely loved the Taycan, like really, really loved it, and Porsche very kindly kind of insured her to drive it, and she just loved it.
It was
so
great thing.
She'd have that.
And Sport Turismo guys would be the one for me. Just more practical.
I wouldn't say no to having that and something like an RS4. So the petrol car, just to kind of balance them off.
Yeah, I'm not forcing a Taycan on you. So you've got an RS6.
No,
you've got an F1,
a Taycan, and an F1. That's three. I'd have a track day special car. I'd have something like a Caterham 420S or something like that. I love my Caterham, and that's probably the only car I've ever had where it was a real special Sunday car. I'd take that out just to go out for a drive.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever had a car before or since where I'd literally get in it just to go out for a drive.
Yeah, just for the
and even
experience.
Some press cars, when I have those, just to go out on a Sunday, I'd just get in it and I'd just go out for a couple of hours drive, and I'd do that quite happily every weekend. So I think a Caterham or some kind of track car. But I think Caterham nail it, to be honest, in terms of, you know, you can look at things like a KTM Crossbow or something, but I think Caterhams are just mega little things.
They are just phenomenal. They're just phenomenal little things. And in fact, that reminds me, I need to hassle them to let me have a go in another car.
Definitely. I probably wouldn't go as mad as a 620 because I think 420 for me is the sweet spot there, just over a couple hundred horsepower. Because mine was 150 horsepower super light, and it was quick, but it could have just had a little bit more. And I think that's what the 420 would give me.
Yeah.
The last one would be I'd really like some kind of off-roader type thing, either something like a Wrangler Rubicon or a Defender, an old Defender, a really nice, you know, old shape Defender 90. Like an urban one or something, you know, it's really nice. I've always loved Defenders. I know they're terrible cars to live with, but I've always loved them. And I'd quite fancy a Defender, I think.
Yeah, it'd be quite a good, add another element, a bit of off-roading.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I've done a fair bit of off-roading and did some last year I'm going to do some really cool stuff later this year, actually. I'm going to Morocco to drive across the desert with an armed forces charity later this year. And it's great fun. So, yeah, something like that would be wicked.
Yeah.
There you go. Is that five?
Yeah. That's five. That's five.
I need to do my lottery numbers now so I can actually afford to buy any of those.
I'll admit, as much as I like the idea of electric cars, I still love petrol powered cars. And when I saw that you can now get a V8 in the new Defender, and specifically I was like, a new 90 with a V8 in it. I was like, that's just a cool thing. Like, it's not, how is that not a cool little car to cruise around in?
Quite a lot of money.
I might
just go back slightly and change my mind. If I'm having a Taycan Turismo, instead of the RS4, I'd actually have a Delta Integrale. Ooh. I think a rally spec Lancia Delta Integrale. I drove one of those recently. They are, to get a good Integrale now, you're looking at 80 grand.
Wow.
For a special edition one. But I've got a friend of mine who's got a beautiful rally spec one in the martini colours and stuff. And he'll make one for you. And they're about 100 grand. And I would just die for one of them in the garage. That would be wicked.
Yes.
I might almost not have the Caterham and the RS4 just to have that. Because that would be wicked.
So, no, that sort of style of car, and I was chatting to someone about this yesterday, about rally, like road spec rally cars with their slightly lifted, slightly more supple suspension, like on the road, that is the sort of car you want to be driving because it'll move around, you can feel the weight balance go everywhere, you can play with it, and it'll be super comfy.
And they might, I mean, my mate's Delta rally car is running 370 horsepower and it's full FIA spec, so it's all ready to go. And the noises it makes are just phenomenal. You just think you're driving a Group B car, basically. Yeah. It's just fantastic.
No, awesome. If you could only drive one car for the rest of your life and you're allowed to have £500 something on the side.
£500?
No, on the side.
To buy the car.
One car, rest of life, plus
£500
on the side.
Wow, that's a good question, actually. It would probably be a fast wagon of some kind, I think, that kind of does it all.
Mm.
You know, I've mentioned that RS4, RS6 before. They're just such good cars. They do everything. They're four-wheel drive. They're loads of space. They're fast if you want them to be. They're comfy if you want them to be. So I think if it was a can't drive anything other than that, it would probably be a fast wagon like an RS4 or an RS6. An old banger. I just love an old Mini, but you can't get an old Mini for 500 quid anymore.
No, they've gone up.
They're quite expensive now. I'd love a classic Mini at some stage, but they're like all of these things. If you miss the bandwagon on them, then you're stuffed, really.
Oh, not necessarily. You could catch up. Yeah. You could catch up.
I've got to work out what the next big thing is.
Yeah, exactly. And you just have to, your channel, when it gets to a million subscribers, you might be like, I'll complete the Mini garage and get an old one.
Yeah, well, true. Yeah. I could be the next, I don't know, Stradman or something.
Yeah. Right. What is the best value car for under 50K?
I'm going to do an electric one and a petrol one, if I may.
Yeah.
I think the best one of the best cars for under 50 grand would be a Kia e-Niro.
Okay.
I think they're brilliant things.
What is that?
They're a brilliant electric car, and as long as you're happy with driving a Kia. But I think as an all-round driver's car, I don't think you can go too far wrong with something like a little Fiesta ST or a Hyundai i30N, something like that. That would be that type of car, I think. Mm. I think you have to go off the German brands. So, if you know, look at Hyundai i30N or i30N Fastback. They're phenomenal cars to drive and they're not silly money, especially if you bought a year old one.
Yeah.
And they've got amazing warranty. And you know, as an ownership proposition, I think they're brilliant things.
Cool. Absolutely. So yeah, I think
something like that.
Veering off the German for a bit, when I'd had that Fiesta, now people that have owned them for a while will just say I'm an idiot, but I was massively impressed by the sort of build quality feel of the car. Like, you shut the door and it's like, thunk. That was not an image I had of a Fiesta until
it wasn't like that until quite recently. I think Ford in the last maybe 5 years or so, they've just upped their game. Their interiors have got a lot better because they used to be a bit rubbish, really. But yeah, and the new Focus is the same. It's a really lovely car. Drive a Focus ST Line or ST. They're lovely, lovely things.
Yeah, they've come a long way.
Yeah, they sure have.
Final question. What is the most interesting car to you at the moment?
We mentioned the Gordon Murray one. Yeah. In terms of high-end car, that or Valkyrie. I just think from an engineering point of view, I could read stuff about them and listen to videos and interviews with Gordon Murray or Adrian Newey till the end of time. I just find them really, really interesting.
Yeah.
Cars I'm really looking for, the car I'm really looking forward to getting my hands on is the Hyundai Ioniq 5, which is a new EV that they've only just released renders of it, but it just looks brilliant. And if it's anything like the other electric cars that Hyundai do, it will be a good car, which might surprise people because they might be thinking, you know, surely it's the new Mini or the...
Wow, that is, you know, a cool looking thing.
I just think it's going to be... It's a really cool, isn't it? You've just pulled out. It looks like a kind of got some Quattro in there, yeah. And it's a really interesting, cool car.
That is, and it's, yeah, it is. But how big is it? Is it a small car?
It's compact SUV type size, okay. I think. Again, I'm desperate to get my hands on one because I don't know what the time frame is in terms of them being available. But I just think if they're using the set, because Kia do that, the Hyundai. Do some great electrics as well, because they all use the same Kia and Hyundai. They very similar electric platform underneath, so it will have good range. It will have you know, nice interior, loads of tech, and it's not going to be silly money. So.
Yeah, I'm all about it. I think it's amazing how loads of brands now are starting to make really cool looking cars. It doesn't have to be you've got to go to the high end German brand to get a good looking car. There's all these other brands are making really cool looking stuff.
The one I like, Cupra Formentors, are really cool as well.
That's another lifted one, isn't it?
it's a kind of SUV, compact SUV type form, but just again,
interesting.
It's quite a cool looking car.
It's quite
it's like a Golf R underneath. It's a 300 horsepower four wheel drive.
I'm somewhere in the middle of SUV. I understand a lot of people like them. And I sort of like them, but I sort of don't. And if it's a performance car, I'm like, well, we'll just get a lower car. It's nice to have some things in the middle, I guess. People buy them. People love their Macan turbos or whatever. Cool.
Yeah, it's a good car, though.
Is there anything you want to shout out? Where can people find you? Find you on Instagram?
Well, obviously, find me on YouTube on Petrol Pet. Have an eye out for Vintage Voltage on D-Max on Fridays if you're in the UK.
Yeah.
So it's been a good series. Just head over to the channel if you like cars or your bikes. Then I'm on Instagram and Facebook. Just search for Petrol Pet and you will find me. And hopefully you'll subscribe and, you know, we'll get even maybe 150,000 subscribers one day.
Yeah. Well, maybe. Well, we'll see. Well, next time you come back on in the unknown amount of time, we'll hit another milestone. Maybe it'll be 500. That would be a good one.
I did 50,000 in the last year, so I've doubled the channel size in a year. So hope you never know. In a year's time, maybe I'll be
200, 250. That'd be good. I'm definitely going to check out some of your cycling content because it's something I'm slightly interested in.
Yeah, you are a cyclist, so the bike we're building, you are. It's nuts. Mm. Yeah,
I'll have
it's
going to
be amazing.
Cool. Amazing. Thanks very much.
Brilliant. Pleasure as always, mate. And next time, hopefully, we'll be able to share a coffee in person rather than doing it over the over the internet.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.